what flying has taught me is actually how to manage risk. Because this is the one thing you don't want to screw up on, right? The takeoff is the only optional part.
To the Raven Cast. The Raven Cast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where you can help us talk about violence and religion and conflict and paths to peace in the world. And today I am so excited because we have Cameron Trimble on the show today. Hi, Cameron.
Hello. Great.
It's fantastic. I'm so glad that we finally got connected. And now we're going to take flight.
But that's because we almost crash landed. So
we almost had a crash landing before we took flight. So, but we were determined because we wanted to take flight. And so that is what we're going to do. Cameron is the author of Piloting Church, Helping Your Congregation Take Flight. And Cameron is Cameron, you are the CEO and the executive director of the Center for Progressive Renewal.
I am.
Yeah, you knew that.
Most days, I can remember that.
I know, right? Most days. before we get to your book, tell us about the Center for Progressive Renewal. You do a lot of coaching and consulting for clergy and for churches. What does that look like? What do you do at the Center for Progressive Renewal?
So we began about 10 years ago as a kind of experiment in mainline church primarily to create a play space, if you will, for entrepreneurial leaders anyone who wanted to start new churches, which is my background, or anyone who wanted to renew a congregation, which is now also my background. Wow. We have this incredible team of coaches, consultants. We care very deeply about healthy local churches. We think that that's one of the best ways to make a more just and generous world, which is why we're really in this. I'm a UCC pastor. My background is also United Methodist. So I've got a real passion for what happens at the local church level, though I've served at the denominational level and now as a national church consultant for a lot of years.
Nice. So if somebody were to want to consult with you or get coached by you, what would that look like? How would they do that?
They just go to the website at progressiveprogressive.org. Okay. And Greg Carlson on our team is the guy to talk to. And then we just figure out what's needed and if we can make a difference. And then we'll see where it goes from there.
Awesome. Cool. You can do stuff online, obviously, like how we're doing.
That's so right.
So geography is not an issue. So awesome. So yeah, go check that out. What is the website?
It's progressiverenewal.org.
Awesome. Great. Yeah. And now let's get to Piloting Church. Yes. Fantastic book. I am the pastor of a UCC church. And I was reading it and I was like, man, I really like this is about church leadership, but it's not just for pastors. It's like for councils and anybody who wants to. And I was also reading it and thinking, man, this would be really great, not just for churches, but for other 501c3s and even businesses if they are feeling grounded and want to take flight.
That's right. Yeah. My real passion is leadership. And what I've discovered is that the most powerful organizations that we have, whether they're churches or NGOs or for-profit companies, and I've got background in all of them because I've owned and started companies, secular nonprofits, and then churches. What I've discovered is that when you see an organization working really well, it's almost always because the leadership that is driving it is healthy and is in alignment and is grounded and has done the internal work needed to lead that organization solidly. So I've now become incredibly passionate about investing my life energy in what I call conscious leadership. And that is leveling up our leadership game so that as we're leading these congregations forward in particular, we're making a real difference, a meaningful difference in our communities.
Wow, that's good. You have put together two of your passions,
yes,
piloting and church together, because as I saw the title and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I was reading it, I was like, oh, that's that is really good. That is, that works really, really well. What, how did you get interested in being a pilot?
Well, in fact, I should just go ahead and confess that the main reason I wrote this book is because what I really like to talk about is aviation. So it gave me an excuse to just break out in aviation metaphors constantly,
nice.
All the time. And so I have been flying since I was a little girl. My uncle owned a little Bonanza, Beechcraft Bonanza airplane, and he and I used to climb into that plane and go fly sometimes to destinations and sometimes just go play in the skies. And I think that that it gets in your blood. Yeah. And what I began to realize is, for me, I mean, I'm deeply passionate about church, but I am most alive when I'm in the air. In fact, when we get off of here, I'm going to go jump in my plane. So it is so much a part of who I am, and so much, I get so much joy in taking people up in planes and teaching them about aviation. And, it's been such a good teacher for me as a human. So this book actually brings together those two great loves, as you pointed out. So it was so much fun to write. I have had people say, you know, like, geez, she really likes to fly. Like, I might have talked about it a little too much. Like, you know, you get a little ground school in this book too. But
yeah, right. No, I for me it worked perfectly, mm-hmm. and we're going to get into that. But what? How did you get interested in church? Was church a big part of your youth growing up, like piloting was?
It was a little bit. I grew up in a family that we would occasionally go to church. And then as I grew older, I got more and more involved in that. And I tell a story that a couple of years ago, I was going through a box of old photos of my bedroom when I was growing up. And it had not occurred to me until I saw these photos that, you know, like normal human beings, normal teenagers have okay. like posters of, you know, the teenage heartthrob of the day, or, you know, like the bands or whatever you're into. And I had pictures of like starving children and polluted rivers and, you know, like all of the broken places in the world. So from a young age, apparently, I have been deeply sensitive to the ways that we can harm each other and our planet. And, you know, when you're a young person and you're making decisions about how you want to invest your life and your career, and I happen to be at a point where going into ministry made the most sense at that point. And it served me well. I've had an extraordinary adventure serving in a lot of different denominational settings. So it's been a real privilege.
Yes, I had I had Backstreet Boys on my wall.
Did you?
Yeah, no, I didn't. No.
Yeah, I was like, well, we'll talk about that offline.
Yes, we can do that offline. I had Michael Jordan up on my walls. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But what are a few, let's just talk about a few of the lessons where your piloting experience can help us with church life.
I think one of the early lessons, and this comes out in conversations, and it always surprises me, when I talk about flying and I talk about, or inevitably after I'm done, like if I'm keynoting or speaking at an event, somebody will come up and say, it seems like you're really, like you like risk, you know, like you're not afraid, right? And I say back to them, actually, it's the total opposite. What flying has taught me is actually how to manage risk. Because this is the one thing you don't want to screw up on, right? The takeoff is the only optional part, right? You know? So I've learned every one of us feels fear, and the leadership challenge is to push through that and keep doing what you were made to do. Just keep putting your next foot forward, take your next best step, and trust your training. Because what you learn in flying is, and I talk about this in the book, you would think that you'd go through hours of ground school before they'd ever put you in a plane. But the truth is, the way you learn to fly is you just fly. Like the very first lesson that I ever took, official lesson, this poor man just put me in a cockpit and said, go, you know, and then was relentless in training me on if this goes wrong, this is what you do. If this goes wrong, you know. So, and if this goes right, this is what you do, right? So I learned to trust that. There was a second leadership lesson that has proven incredibly important to me. And that is, at some point in any hobby like this or career like this, you have to make a decision if at what level you're going to play the game or at what level you're going to develop the art in yourself. And for me, I decided, mainly because I had really great people around me encourage me to keep upping my game, that I wanted to play at the professional level. Like, I don't want to be the amateur pilot who, you know, flies and is just kind of lucky to land and bounces down the runway and, you know, is sloppy in what she does. Any more than I want to be an amateur pastor or an amateur leader, right? So when a professional gets up to do what they do in the world, their first thought is about that thing, right? So if I'm a professional athlete, I'm thinking, what's my workout going to be? What's my nutrition? Who are my teammates? How can I support them? How can we up our game of, or our level of play together if we're in team sport, right? Everything I do is geared that direction. Now, if I'm an amateur, I'm just like, I might stretch a little before I walk out onto a field, right? Or I might, dust off my old aviation book and read about airspace before I go jump in my plane. I don't want to play at that level, and I don't really want to work with people who do. You know, I want to work with the pros, and I think that's true for most of us. So there's a real difference I've learned between continuing to up your game and surround yourself with people who want to up their game too, so you all level up together. Or, you know, I mean, I'm amateur at a lot of things, like amateur chef, amateur crossfitter, amateur all kinds of things. But on my leadership area, in my leadership and in my vocation and in my flying, I don't want that.
Yes, we've got some listeners and watchers. Karin Roach says, I'm listening. So hi, Karin. Thank you for listening. And if other people have comments or questions that you want to make, feel free to put those in the chat room and we will bring them in. One of the, you mentioned fear, and I have a great fear of heights. And whenever I fly somewhere, I always make sure to sit in the dreaded aisle section because I don't want to look out the window. And fear is one of the big things that keeps churches from taking flight. I would imagine.
That's right. It is, and it's a curious thing because I actually think that's a fairly modern development. And I think what happened is that we got this. We tell ourselves the story of decline in irrelevance, and there's data to back it up. It's not like we've totally made this up, but we've used that to justify complacency in some settings, and that kind of narrative creates a certain level of paralysis. So, you know, I actually learned this lesson from a psychologist named Virginia Satir, who was one of the leaders of family systems therapy, and she talks about what it means to have self-esteem. And it's not like you feel good about yourself. What she means is that you are so in tune with what you're created to do, and you're so honest about that, and you have such deep integrity within yourself in your offering that to the world, that when you offer it, the power of it does change the game. And I think what's happened in so many of our congregations is that we've lost our self-esteem. We've abdicated some of our integrity. We've forgotten why we exist. We don't realize or don't recognize the difference that we can make in the world. And so what we've started to do is just maintain institution for lack of a better thing to do. And I think one of the opportunities we have right now, especially as we're deconstructing our systems, which I reckon there's enormous grief in that process, but then there's a huge opportunity, is that we get to pioneer a new age here. And if we can recapture our authenticity, our relevance, our reasons for being and why it matters that we have healthy congregations, I think we've got an enormous future in front of us.
What is our reason for being as churches?
Well, I mean, most simply put, I think that churches at their very best create loving people. Mm. Like, I think when you go to church or when you're in a Christian community, you should look a little more like Jesus at the end of the day, right? You should be a little kinder, a little more compassionate, a little more at peace in yourself, a little clearer about who you are and whose you are. And then the outcome of that, the evidence that we could see from that, is that we make our communities more just and generous. So, like, my obsession is, I don't know why we need so many mainline churches or churches, period, unless in every single place one of those churches exists, the quality of life for the people living in those communities is on the rise. So, like, imagine if everywhere there was a United Methodist Church or everywhere there's a Presbyterian Church, we could promise the community that the quality of life for the people living around that church would be on the rise, that we would be as obsessed about crime rates as we are about attendance, and, you know, obsessed about graduation and employment opportunities as we are about giving, right? It's that turning ourselves inside out. I mean, I think in going, doing the ministry and mission, I think there's enormous, I think that's our future.
It's one of the things that I love about your book is that you have this really hopeful and inspiring tone to it. And you say that one of the issues is that churches need to dream bigger.
Yeah.
And I see this in what you're just saying is like the kind of like part of the reason that we've come to exist is to just exist.
Right.
The institutional building and stuff and keeping up with all of these, you know, it's a lot of money to keep the building up.
That's right. That's right.
And how do we dream big amidst, I mean, hey, like we live in strange times, right?
And, we do, though not as strange, I think. Well, I suppose it depends on how we define strange, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think actually we know a little more than we give ourselves credit for, as far as the shifts in how people gather, the shifts in what people are looking for, the shifts in how we can contribute as people of faith. So there are a few thoughts I have on this. One of the crises I think we've got in the religious sector in particular is we're becoming a closed system. In that we're not consulting, we're not engaging other industries in any strategic way to learn from them. And so what we're doing is, like, I used to have a landscaping company, and I often joke that it never occurred to me to go to another landscaping company that was going out of business and ask them how to run mine. Hmm. Right. But when I go to these denominational meetings, or when I, you know, work with some of these congregations, what I'm realizing is that that's actually what we're doing. We're just trading the wisdom we're gaining from our own sector in our own little bubble. Now, other work I do in the world has me out in a lot of other different places. You know, I'm in major tech companies doing work there, and I'm at major corporations doing, you know, work in the business sector and the financial industry, et cetera, and law enforcement. When you can access that level of cross-pollination, the ideas that come to you are just natural. They become obvious, and they become innovative in your space. So my first plea to religious leaders, regardless of where you're located in the system, is, like, get out more. Yeah. Go gather some ideas, go meet cool people, go have interesting conversations, because it sparks your own creativity. It's how you level up. And so I would say that that's really our starting place for how we dream bigger dreams. The second thing I would just simply add is, and then believe we can live into them. Mm. So we can at moments have a very negative and pessimistic view of our future. And that's unhelpful. So, you know, believe in your own possibility and then work towards that instead of sitting and offering critique of everyone else who's trying to really make a go of this. We're all having fun doing it.
Yeah, there is a lot of pessimism about the church dying.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that just kind of weighs me down as a young-ish pastor, I guess, is this narrative that all of these churches are supposed to be dying. It's just, as you said, it's self-defeating. And I see so much hope, as you do, in part developing relationships with other people outside of church. It's never helpful to isolate ourselves. And also, just like part of piloting or part of being up in a plane, even though it freaks me out sometimes, is that you get this expansive view of the world, right? It's so much bigger than our, I don't know, fears, our problems. And that's, in a sense, what God is all about, right? Giving us some kind of bigger, there's something bigger going on here. And if we just get in the plane go along with it, it's going to be okay. But instead we get all of this fear about it. So.
Right. And I can go on for hours about different altitudes and what you see at different altitudes.
Yeah,
that matters. And here's what really does matter about it. That I just want to plant this seed in your listeners' minds. What we have to understand is that everything is already in relationship. So what's on the ground is already in relationship with what's at 30,000 feet. It's just that we can't always see it. So when something's not working, the wise path is to either go up or go down, but shift your viewpoint so that you can begin to see new ways things are in relationship that then open up new possibilities for you. So let me give you an example. It could very well be that probably 75 to 85% of mainline congregations will close in the next, let's say, 50 years, maybe a shorter time period, right? Because the way they're structured is a little bit like a BlackBerry trying to survive or thrive in a iPhone or whatever is to come. I'm scared of what is to come, but whatever is to come kind of world, right? Now, the BlackBerry still works, like it still functions, kind of, sort of, but nobody's maintaining it, right? There's no new infrastructure coming online. Like, that's not our future. We know that, right? But if we can strategically let go of that technology and embrace what is coming to move resources, to move assets, then as we begin to see how all this is in relationship, we make better decisions about how we invest in our future.
What do you see as coming?
I see local churches still continuing to thrive. I think a lot of local churches, there's powerful vitality there. And because they're so close to the ground, literally, their capacity to do the good work of the gospel is easy to live out, or easier than in some other places in denominational structures, right? I also see the deconstruction of denominations, and I wish we were being more strategic about it. Right now it's happening haphazardly, and we're seeing sort of tribalism break out, where it's really based on relationships and what can be negotiated right now. There is no 50 to 100 year vision in operation that I can see at the moment, right? So I see all of us individuals still wanting to be deeply loving spiritual people, still wanting to engage in this way of life, and not needing to join a thing necessarily. Not necessarily needing a building all the time, though I think they're very helpful some of the time. I know clergy are going to have to get reoriented into this new world and the role that they play as facilitator instead of resident expert. But what I do see ultimately is a pretty bright future. But it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Okay.
Great news, we get to preside over that.
Yes.
It's going to be amazing.
We get to fly into that. And Karen has a question that I think is also going to lead me into my next question. I'll go with Karen's though. So how do you convince your church community to let go and move in a different direction?
Well, it's never easy, is it? The way I tend to think about this is that there are some of us in the world who are willing to make major change because we can see a vision of the world that we like better than what we've currently got. So there's a part of a percentage of our population that is that needs a vision that's exciting, that's compelling, and that's worthy of giving their life energy to. There's another part of our population, I fear it's a larger part, that is more fear-based. And what they will be motivated by is an unpreferred future. So so here's how I might say it. If we don't do something to change the way that we're operating as a local church, then in 2 years from now, we will burn through all of our endowments. We won't have any support for our young people. We won't have any relevance in the community. And we're going to be talking about selling this building and closing down. But imagine if we work together right now, and if we could build partnerships that drew in new energy to our system, and we could find new foundations and funding partners who would align with our vision, and if we could make a meaningful difference in the quality of life for people in our community, imagine what would be possible for us moving forward. So it's those two stories that have to be told together that I think can open up some of these systems. And it's just being wise about how you talk about it. And if only talking about it was the solution. So I've just given a very simple, example to a complicated challenge. But
well, I love your example because it, as you say, you're not just like providing criticism. And I mean, you have a very realistic view of where the church is at the moment, which was helpful for me to open my eyes and to see clearly where we're at and how we can lead or pilot this thing into a better direction. Yeah. And that's key. One of the things that you say, this goes along with Karen's question, is that there is a myth out there that churches that are free of conflict are healthy churches. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there are times where there's conflict in the plane amongst the pilot and the co-pilot and what do you do and stuff. What do we do with conflict? You say that actually thriving churches have conflict in them. So what do we do with that?
Well, it's I personally see low levels of conflict, not outright, you know, let's destroy each other levels of conflict, but low levels of conflict is a healthy sign that people care enough to invest energy in the conversation, in the community, in this body that you form together. So we should normalize that conflict is part of what it means to be church. Like, church is messy. We're all messy humans. And then we get together as a group and we just get messy all over each other. And That just is, right? So for us to have created a mythology that conflict is bad or that conflict has to be terribly destructive, I think is that just that. It's a mythology. So let's normalize some of it. There are certain leadership capacities that are helpful if you develop in negotiating and flying your way through that, right? Most conflict I have found comes from unarticulated anxiety that comes out in competing commitments, beliefs, and values. So if you can surface those, then and people can overhear it, then what you then try to do is continue to surface them such that you can achieve alignment between the various parties, so that they can become more aligned in their commitments, values, and beliefs as you're working together, right? So that's the art of leadership. When you're not fighting, it means either you're in denial, you're being too polite, you're suppressing real issues that are will be below the surface and will explode at some point, or you just don't care. And neither of those options are good. So it's, I don't want people to think, you know, Cameron's all about fighting. That's all constantly. But I've learned to see that it's actually a healthy thing in most situations, not always.
Well, yeah, I mean, Jesus, you know, he says, before you go and make your sacrifice at the temple, if you have something against your brother or sister, go get that figured out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And that goes back to the integrity thing and the, you know, about self-esteem. It's where things get wonky for everyone and where it's a no win for anyone is when someone or someones have compromised their integrity in community. Because at that point, you can't, until that's fixed, you can't move forward in healthy ways. And by integrity, I just mean the alignment of who you are and who you are presenting yourself to be. So, you know, so it's not just a, you know, I did something bad. It's actually, I am misaligned with who I'm committed to be as a person. And that creates a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the challenges that we have that you mentioned in the book is simply getting our message out there.
Yes.
And this is one of the things that I find particularly difficult for Christians who identify as progressive.
Yes.
Because we tend to be, it comes with some kind of shame with being Christian. I have blamed other Christians for ruining Christianity for me. And I don't want to be one of those Christians, right? And
yeah.
So how do we get the message out there? That's one of the big things. But also, how do we get the message out there without demonizing other Christians who have, like, ruined Christianity?
Yeah. So I'm with you in that. I totally feel that pain. I will confess on Facebook to the world that there are moments when I'm tired and in an airport and someone asks me what I do for a living and I tell them I'm in the nonprofit turnaround business instead of telling them I'm a pastor, right? So we should start by acknowledging that the brand of Christianity is damaged. It just is. And it is uncomfortable for us to wear. Now, the question is it irrevocably damaged? Is it, has the evangelical theology, which our national media seems to really be obsessed with, is that message so powerful that, in fact, it's causing so much damage in the world that we may not be able to fix that? So if that's the case, then that's a different kind of work. And that's going to require a different level of bravery on all of our parts. And that's a different conversation that we should have.
Mm-hmm.
But in the interim, while we're discerning if that is the case, at the very least, we should be working on two levels. The first level is we need a national media strategy. The reason that the theology that gets promoted in the world does is because there is a whole machinery, a whole infrastructure that exists that gets out theological talking points to charismatic speakers who are intentionally invited onto national news outlets to spew some stuff that makes the rest of us terribly uncomfortable. Now, let's be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves in this. Let's level up our game. So we can play that same game. We have an equally compelling message that is far more redemptive, that is far healthier for the common good, that could actually save our planet. Like, there's never been more at stake in our kind of theology, which is just and generous and collaborative and for the common good. Our kind of theology needs to get out there, or we're headed towards an outcome that's terribly devastating for all of humanity and our planet. So we need to get serious about what is our national approach to this. Who are the leaders we want to promote to the major news outlets? What are the talking points after every major event? And we possibly want a person of faith talking points need to be distributed. We need to be organized. And in every one of our communities, faith leaders need to step up to getting their voices out into their media outlets locally. Now, I don't mean clergy do. In most of my writing and most of my work, I don't make distinction between clergy and lay leader. Every one of us is a faith leader. And if you're interested in being a public leader, then I'm talking to you about this. One of the most valuable encounters I ever had was a guy named Mackie Alston, who taught me how to create a messaging triangle. And the discipline he instilled in me is that every single time we have a major thing happen in a community, I instantly go and create a messaging triangle, whether I need to or not. You figure out your core message, then you figure out a supporting scripture, you figure out supporting statistics, and then you figure out a supporting story. So that if you have the chance to get to speak on television or on the radio or within a podcast or write an op-ed, you've already done the work so that you're ready to do that. So we've got to be ready to step into the opportunities that come our way.
That messaging triangle that you have in the book, that was worth the price of the book, that those like 3 or 4 pages that you had in there. And everything else in the book is fantastic too. But that was like a really practical, here's how you do it, here's how you get the message out. And for me, that's like one of the most important things that we need to do is get our message out, because for too long, we progressives have been hiding it, and it's doing nobody any good. We don't have time to hide it anymore. So
that's right.
So thank you for that part of your book in particular. What gives you, in your work at the Center for Progressive for Renewal, what gives you hope?
A number of things. One is, again, we have the privilege of working with congregations who care, who want to level up. So they may be in trouble. They may be very fragile. They may be looking at closing, but they care enough to reach out and to invest and to most of the time do the hard work. And I'll just be blunt, if they're not willing to do the hard work, then we cancel the contract, right? Like life is too short, and we don't want to waste their money, and we don't want to waste our time. So we get to work with leaders who are starting new ministries and who are dreaming of new technologies, if you will, that we could use to help people be more loving and kind and look a little more like Jesus. And sometimes that looks like a congregation, and sometimes that looks like an app or a VR goggle space, you know? So like we get to work in a lot of cool different environments. And then we get to work with really strong churches, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 member or 8,000 member churches that are trying to figure out how they serve as a cathedral, in a sense, to support other congregations. How do they expand their reach and their impact? So getting to work in systems that dream like that, that's great. And then we're working with a lot of congregations who are facing their death, possibly, unless they want to rewrite a story. And that's part of the work that we get to do with them. So ultimately, it's pretty cool work.
That's awesome.
You know? Yes. I mean, like, I'm not going to complain. And it's across so many denominations. So that's the other fun thing, is like, it's not just one tribe. Like, we get to work with everybody. And that gives us a good perspective of what's really going on.
That's cool. So you tell a lot of stories in the book, which makes it very engaging. one of the stories you tell near the end is about 9/12, the day after 9/11, mm-hmm. and what happened, and especially in Canada.
That's right.
Yeah. And so much of our memory of 9/11 is just the tragedy, which is important to remember. But amidst the tragedy, there were stories of hope and love and living out the way of Jesus, as you've been talking this whole time. So can you tell us about that story and why it was important to add to this book?
Well, there's a musical that's been out now for a little while. It's called Come From Away. And the reason it's so dear to me is because one of the lead characters in it is a female pilot named Beverly Bass. She was one of the first female pilots at American Airlines to fly the, I think it was the 777. The story is about what happened on 9/11 and her needing to do things like first discovering that the airspace in the United States had been closed, and then needing to find a new location to land. And then this is little tiny place called Gander, and she's got to land this huge plane with, you know, 200 and something people on it on a runway that's barely long enough and that whose concrete is not built to hold a plane that weighs that much, right? And so she has to do things like dump fuel over the ocean, which is regrettable if you're an environmentalist, but think through all of those kinds of things. And then they get through this, and then they realize the enormity of what's happened means they're going to be in Gander for a little while. And so they form a community. It literally doubles Gander's population overnight. And the town people embrace the plane people is what they named them. And they formed a community whose bonds exist to this day. And for me, that became a story of enormous hope for the future of our church and enormous hope for the future of humanity, frankly, that we are going through unprecedented change and we are witnessing the deconstruction of systems that many people have given their lives to. So the pain of that cannot be understated. And we also have the opportunity now, through the relational networks that we can form and through our shared common commitment to building a more just and generous world, we can architect a different kind of future, a 9/12 kind of future that is honest about who we are, what we are, and is committed to building a future that is for the common good. So I do think that the church with the big C is at a tipping point. So we will either find our way again and build a relevant, powerful future for local congregations and people of faith to continue to live out this way of life, or we will die of irrelevancy, and we should. So today is the day. Like, I think the decisions we make in these next couple of years determine who we will be 50 to 100 years from now. So no pressure. I'm totally in it with all of you.
Yeah. I love it. It's the reality that you put forth in the book. And it's a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. I think it would make a great book study for churches. It is filled with the reality of the present situation and also filled with hope and inspiration about how we can pilot this thing forward. So, Cameron, thank you so much for being here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for interviewing me.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people want to keep up with your work, how can they do that?
Well, they can like me on all the social media things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, all that. And then go to progressiverenewal.org and you can find me there.
Fantastic. Thank you, everybody, for watching. And you can stay up to date with the Raven cast on the Raven Foundation Facebook page and also at the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. And you can find a recording of this video there in the next few days. Why don't you share it with some of your friends? Because Cameron brought us some awesome stuff in this video. So go ahead and share that with your churches and your friends. So, and get the book, Piloting Church, wherever great books are sold. Awesome. All right, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.